dit de eerste stap naar afstel is.
Ja, laten we dat alsjeblieft hopen. En ja, kunnen we nog wat doen? Want die krant moet nog verder verspreid worden, hè? Of is die krant al voldoende verspreid? Hoe zit dat?
Nee, we hebben een tweede druk. Hij is heel goed verspreid, zo goed dat we een tweede druk hebben gedaan. En dus we zijn weer naastig op zoek naar mensen die de volgende helft willen gaan doen. Het loopt iets minder storm omdat mensen het te glad vinden. Dus heel graag je melden via info@behoudlutkemeer.nl als je jouw straat en de omliggende wil voorzien van een goede krant.
Ja, eigenlijk dringt het nu pas tot me door. Maar je komt eigenlijk met een soort van goed nieuws. Er is uitstel, dus waarschijnlijk wordt het afstel, want het was ook maar een optie. Kan je dat nog één keer zeggen? Want ik wil ook wel eens het goede nieuws goed horen.
Ja, precies. Nee, dus eigenlijk, je moet het zo zien. Ze hebben al in 2019 gezegd, ja, we hebben iemand. Begin 2019 was dat. Dat heeft een jaar geduurd. Toen hebben ze begin 2020 zijn ze over de brug gekomen en zeiden ze van de gemeente, ja nee, er is nu echt een reserveringsovereenkomst getekend. Nou, wij zeiden toen al, jongens, een reserveringsovereenkomst, dat zegt niks, want dat is niks meer dan wat het zegt. Een reservering en echt zonder juridische consequenties. In de normale gang van zaken zijn die gemiddeld 4 maanden geldig. En dat kan wel eens uitlopen naar 6. We zijn nu weer een jaar verder en nog steeds is er alleen maar een reserveringsovereenkomst en komt nu het verhaal dat er uitstel is gevraagd. En nou, je maakt ons gewoon niet wijs dat is omdat die kandidaat zo ontzettend staat te trappelen om daar te bouwen. Dat is volgens mij gewoon omgekeerd, dat de gemeente staat te trappelen om mensen te vinden die daar willen gaan bouwen en dat daar nog steeds grote twijfels en vraagtekens zijn.
Joehoe! Wat goed om te horen. Ja, ik denk ook dat het is. En dat die klootzakken van het bedrijf op Schiphol, dat die grond verhuurt, ja, dat die gewoon inderdaad misschien wel zand moeten happen.
Ja, zeker. En weet je, nogmaals, dat begint nu ook langzaam bij mensen ook hier in de buurt nog meer door te dringen. In dat stedenbouwkundig plan staat gewoon ook doodleuk een stukje ingetekend wat gereserveerd is om een afrit naar de A5 te maken. Nou, als je vanaf de Rutkemeerpolder een afrit naar de A5 wil maken, dan moet je dwars door de Oostdorpen bovenpolder door de weilanden heen. En de mensen staan er helemaal niet bij stil, maar A zeggen betekent op termijn ook B zeggen en C zeggen. En dan is de volgende polder aan de beurt. En ik denk dat als iedereen zich dat eens laat doordringen, dat we dan ook met z'n allen echt een vuist kunnen gaan maken. En dat het niet alleen maar gaat over de Lutkemeer.
Alice, ik ben toch heel vrolijk geworden. Al weten we nog helemaal niet zeker dat we hebben gewonnen. Ik ben nu al blij. Ik verheug me al op de zomer en lekker weer. En dan even langs de Lutkemeerpolder. Maar ja, oké. Heb je nog iets aan toe te voegen aan dit gesprek?
Nee, heel goed. Laten we onze successen vieren. En ook vooral, niet alleen vieren, maar ook weer gaan tuinieren. Dus in het voorjaar, hou het in de gaten. Wij gaan weer de Lutkemeer betrekken om daar tuintjes aan te leggen.
Het klinkt supergoed. Alice, ontzettend bedankt dat je dit hebt willen vertellen. En tot snel maar weer.
Joe, tot snel.
Wat voor serieus Germaine André met activisme, kunst, actualiteit. Ik denk dat we nu dan maar eens eventjes overgaan naar... Ja, Portland. Er is niets gebeurd in Portland. Het enige wat ik daar zie is dat er wel heel veel onderzoek wordt gedaan naar politietactieken en technieken en strategieën. Er is bijvoorbeeld die ene gast die zich... mag ik wel gast zeggen, want hij is ook nog trans. Dus dan diegene die hij is, die persoon, die... Ja, die doet steeds meer onderzoek naar die gifgassen. Dus zodra er Black Lives Matter demonstraties zijn, dan komen mannetjes in een soort ruimte pakken en die beginnen dan allemaal chemicaliën op de mensen af te schieten. En daar wordt behoorlijk goed onderzoek naar gedaan. Dat het giftig is, dat je daar dood aan gaat. En dat er eigenlijk de afgelopen 50 jaar allemaal doden zijn gevallen.
Well, hello, Bart.
Why, hi, Brian. You're live on air. I was just explaining to people that there's a lot of research going on in and around Portland into police tactics and techniques of surveillance and also of chemical... poisoning of demonstrators. What I was reading on your Twitter friends' timelines, because your Twitter is a bit silent.
Yeah, it's been pretty quiet. There's not been, you know, not been a lot going on, and I've been kind of taking a break. You know, I got pretty, let's say, burned out on Twitter with all the drama that was going on, you know, at the end of last year and last month. So I just kind of stepped away, and I've been busy with work and some other things. So, but yeah, but there's some interesting things going on. You know, like you said, with this chemical weapons, and there's some lawsuits that I think might be quite helpful across the country if they, you know, if they come together. And then actually, I learned something interesting yesterday. I can't account for the veracity of it, but it comes from one of the ACLU observers who's part of the same lawsuit that I'm part of. She says that 106, 107 sheriff's deputies from Multnomah County, which is one of the two counties Portland's in, 107 of them were all happened to be on leave on January 6th. And no way of knowing where they were at this time, but it's kind of interesting that there'd be so many on leave on that particular day. Particularly when, you know, Multnomah County has, you know, the sheriffs around the, in the area have been known for having some challenging membership, let's say. Questionable, perhaps questionable, controversial, you know.
Membership of
The deputies themselves. No, it's more their attitudes and opinions and prejudices. But somewhat questionable.
You suspect they all went to Washington that day.
I mean, I expect at least some of them were in Washington. And another way of looking at it is that they were on leave, waiting to see what would happen in Washington and whether they would be needed to do something in their personal capacity locally. I think that's another question people have. Sure. But you know, so what I'm hoping is that some intrepid journalists with more time and resources than I have will start calling around to the public information officers at sheriff's departments around the country, and you know, just because I probably can't call if you were a sheriff, right, or a sheriff deputy. I probably couldn't call your boss and be like, I want to know if Bart was on vacation that on this day, right? But if I called and said how many officers were on leave, you know, that's probably public information, or at least information that, you know, should be accessible to the public. Because otherwise, like, how would you know that they were doing their job? Maybe there's chronic absences, right? So if somebody was to do that, you know, let's say even in just 50 or 100 counties around the country in some of the more conservative areas, or, you know, you can even just start by looking at states that are, you know, within a day's drive of Washington, D.C. You know, if it turned out that there was, you know, excessive absences as to what would be expected normally at this time of year on that day, it would be a start, and it would certainly point in a direction.
It's a new year, and, well, stuffs continue to happen. So let's take a look at some recent developments before a deep dive into some Chechen criminals. I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the Crisis Exercise. A few thoughts. I mean, certainly Budanov, he is pretty hawkish, but nonetheless, he is what one could call Washington, D.C. proximate. You know, although there was a sense that Yermak was more associated with the UK, I'm not quite sure if I accept that. I think that really speaks to this notion that somehow it's the Brits who are pushing for war while America is pushing for peace. It's a little bit more complex than that. But main thing is, he is absolutely quite realistic. And indeed, he, despite having in the past made some rather ridiculously bullish statements about retaking Crimea and the like, of late, he's been sounding a lot more sober and realistic about the dangers of Ukraine in the war continuing. Does this mean something for the negotiations? Well, look, I can only assume that he wouldn't accept this position if he felt that Kyiv was either on the verge of some humiliating capitulation or, conversely, dooming itself to a forever war. So presumably he thinks that there's some hopes of some kind of reasonable outcome. I mean, we'll just have to wait and see. And also we'll have to wait and see how the Western press corps deal with him. I mean, in his position as head of HUR, military intelligence, to be perfectly honest, there was a whole genre of quite embarrassingly fawning Western coverage of him. They couldn't get enough of him and his secret base and his little canary. And I won't go into detail. You can easily Google it if you want. We'll see if they actually start treating him as, shall we say, a political figure now, rather than an icon of resistance. And for some, there's already some claims within the commentariat about how it's bad news to have a securocrat, have someone from the intelligence community given a political role. I'm personally not of the same opinion. Actually, look, a good security official, and this is one of the problems, I mean, if one looks at the people at the top of the Russian security apparatus, I wouldn't regard them as good in this respect. But nonetheless, you know, ultimately, the purpose of intelligence is not just simply to kill people and blow things up, as happens in war, but it is also to provide what's known as the best truth to the political leadership. And I think Budanov, therefore, will have a much better idea of the situation militarily. He's going to have to climb quite a steep learning curve on the political and administrative side of things. But nonetheless, I think actually a smart security officer is often going to be that much more capable of navigating the realities rather than just simply thinking about the optics, which is what politicians, quite frankly, tend to focus on. But we'll just have to wait and see. Anyway, the other big news is, of course, Venezuela. I mean, let me be honest. I think from Moscow's point of view, some people are saying, oh, this is a terrible humiliation for Moscow because their client has been taken away and is going to be put on trial in New York. And others are saying, oh, this is great for Moscow because it essentially creates some kind of moral equivalence between the superpowers and essentially provides an implicit justification that a great power just does what it wants. Well, look, I mean, obviously Moscow wasn't going to do anything to protect Maduro because it couldn't do anything, particularly because it looks like there was some kind of stitch-up of a deal. It's not like the Venezuelans were all busy fighting to protect Maduro. And, look, Maduro was never a client like, for example, Assad in Syria, you know, with whom Moscow does have an implicit guarantee that if, you know, all else fails, we will try and get you out and there'll be a luxurious flat or residence outside Moscow waiting for you. You know, Assad, Yanukovych, etc. So I think from their point of view, they didn't really owe him all that much. And in from that context, yeah, exactly. It's no real big deal. To be honest, Putin has been pulling back from what one could think of as the sort of the wider Russian imperial pretension since 2022, when he's had to focus on Ukraine. And look, if he's willing to basically see the South Caucasus fall from Russia's sphere of influence, he's not going to care that much about Venezuela. And the fact that he's adopted such a transactional and compartmentalized approach to policy towards the United States, you know, whereas under Biden, it was basically everything was all in one bucket, shall we say. Now, actually, with the Trump administration, you know, nuclear policy and Ukraine and potential business deals and proliferation, you know, all of these are treated separately. So in some ways, they can provide their pretty mild critique of what's happened in Venezuela without in any way having that affect, for example, the whole issue of Ukraine. Obviously, though, the fact that this is, whatever may be said, you know, a breach of international law, that is no bad thing for the wider Russian narrative. After all, you know, Putin's view is essentially that this is what great powers do, and great powers have spheres of influence. And, you know, if we are going to let America have its Latin American sphere of influence, then the corollary is we should be allowed our Slavic one. Alexei Naumov, who's an expert at the Russian International Affairs Council, RIAC, said in Kommersant, Russia has its own sphere of influence, and no matter how sympathetic we may be to the Bolivarian Republic, Venezuela, it was clear that engaging in an overly active struggle to preserve it today was not only futile, but also frankly unnecessary, given the limitations of its capabilities and the priority of foreign policy objectives. So, you know, there we have a fairly sober analysis that says, look, this doesn't really matter to us too much. So even though we couldn't do anything, even if we could have, we shouldn't. Of course, one also gets the rather more over-egged and distinctly over-rich expressions of moral outrage. I mean, in, I think it was Moskovsky Komsomolets we had this. The Maduro story isn't about Venezuela. It's not even about oil. Maduro may not be respected, accepted, or considered legitimate, but the president of another country is not a trophy. This story is not about Venezuela, but about a world where only force decides. The problem isn't a specific name. The problem is precedent. The moment when might replaces right, and confidence in one's own invulnerability replaces common sense. A world where presidents can be captured and taken wherever one pleases is no longer a world of rules. It's a world where anyone can be taken tomorrow, including Trump himself, if they can get their hands on him. Now, this is not because there's some kind of fear in the Kremlin that Putin can be next or anything like that. But it is quite astonishing the hypocrisy that is being laid bare there, given that this is could be just as easily a description of what they tried to do in Ukraine in February 2022. But again, the hypocrisy is in some ways the virtue from Moscow's point of view. They like a world in which they can, with some degree of justification, claim that, look, doesn't matter what people say, whether they say they're for international law or whatever else. Everyone is basically a self-interested hypocrite, so don't treat us as anything different. Does it mean that the United States is going to be distracted? I mean, certainly one can wonder how the claim that it can it's going to run Venezuela can possibly be operationalized. But on the other hand, look, a superpower can indeed walk and chew gum at the same time. I don't think this is going to have any particular impact on what happens with Ukraine. The only real question is what this means for the further risk of transatlantic divides. You know, the French have been calling this a violation of international law. Kaya Kallas provided a rather mealy-mouthed call for restraint. Keir Starmer, the lawyer, that seems to be about the only really distinguishing factor of the British Prime Minister. And nonetheless, he can't bring himself to criticise any kind of breach of international law. So we'll just have to wait and see if this has any real impact for EU-US relations. Ultimately, again, I don't think so. Moving on, a couple of drone attacks to talk about briefly. So we had the Russian claim that the Ukrainians launched 91 drones at Putin's residence at Valdai in Novgorod region, which always looked pretty iffy. Now, look, some people are saying that there is no evidence of any kind of attack at all, despite some so far, frankly, unverified Russian presentation of some videos, and apparently they have given the Americans the targeting data from a shot down drone. But again, can one actually trust that? I think the answer would be no. However, we've now had, coming from US sources reported in the Wall Street Journal, not just the CIA saying, yes, this was not an attack on Putin's residence, but saying at the same time there was an attack aimed against another military facility in Novgorod region. And this does raise the possibility, and it's a rather worrying one, that the Russians genuinely believe that this was an attack on Putin's residence. After all, you don't really know for sure what the drone's target is going to be. And therefore, the more that the West say, no, it wasn't that, the more that Russia thinks, this is just the West covering for Ukraine, and given that we know that this is a proxy war, that must mean that the West either supported or at least okayed, if not indeed actually initiated, an attack on Putin's residence. So there is the scope for this actually to become still quite a significant issue, and one which is in some ways, with both sides having a degree of right on their side, the Ukrainians not having targeted Putin's residence, the Russians actually genuinely believing that they did. Then we have a second drone attack, which has been much, much less widely covered in the Western press, which was at Khorli, that on New Year's Eve, three drones hit a bar and hotel in Khorli in on the Black Sea coast in occupied Kherson. And so far, the tally is 27 dead, more seriously wounded. Now, the Russians say that these were all civilians. Again, unfortunately, we can't at the moment verify that. But the fact that three drones hit this target suggests this was not an accident, but was indeed targeted. Now, at first, Kyiv just didn't respond at all when it was being asked about this. Then they said, ah, no, actually, this was a military target, that the bar was full of military and political officers. I don't know. Maybe it couldn't be the case. Could also be that they made a mistake, there was a mistargeting, that they may aim to hit somewhere else, or that they thought it was going to be full of army officers and it wasn't or whatever. Again, very difficult in the current sort of fog of war to really know. But it is worth noting that this is still a very big issue for Russians. And indeed, the very fact that the West has given this little attention is indeed being noted. Again, something we must remember, the Russians are much more, frankly, I'd say, obsessive about what the West is saying about Russia and the war than we are the other way round. And therefore, actually, our responses do have an impact on the Russians. So, again, we'll have to wait and see. But this is another area in which actually I think, you know, the Russians are feeling angry. And one might say, well, so what? You know, they're just experiencing what the Ukrainians have gone through day after day, which is entirely true. But the point is, we can't discount the political impact, potentially, of sentiment. We'll have to wait and see quite how that story develops. So at the moment, yeah, lots of stuff happening. Who says this is going to be the quiet season? But nonetheless, in many ways, the actual impacts remain to be seen. Will Budanov's entry into the office of the president of Ukraine help or hinder the peace talks? Could do either. Will Venezuela actually have any real impact on what's going on? I suspect not, though it will be a talking point for the Russians in the global south in particular. Will these drone attacks actually have any serious impact? In and of themselves, no. But the one point I would make about them is precisely that we do see a degree of nationalist outrage that obviously the Kremlin seeks to harness. This is why we have to fight this war with the awful Ukrainians, because they are awful people and we need to do awful things to them as a result. Fair enough. However, as they go on, firstly, they do contribute to a sense that the Kremlin is unable, frankly, to master the Ukrainians. Why is this being allowed to happen? And secondly, it does feed into a, I should stress, small minority, but nonetheless a vocal small minority of ultranationalists who are developing their critique of Putin. That they are saying Putin's problem is that he's actually being too restrained in his conflict. And they will try and mobilize that, especially if there is a peace. They will try and mobilize that to create a kind of stab in the back myth that says, in fact, we could have got much more quickly, if only Putin hadn't been so half-hearted. It may seem bizarre and surreal to suggest that Putin is being criticized for not being aggressive enough in Ukraine, but certainly it is there. An instance like this get used by these nationalists. You know, maybe these are stories which are going to be gone from the public consciousness within a month. But if they're not, then that poses a potential, I think, risk for Putin. Anyway, enough about current affairs. Let's have a break and then let's talk about some criminal history. Specifically, the rise and fall of the Lazanskaya Brigada, one of the most notorious Chechen organized crime groups in Moscow. And then at the end, some reason as to why that actually still matters today.
Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/InMoscowShadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode.
So, the Lazanskaya Brigada. Now, the roots of this organised crime group actually go back to two Chechen students studying in late 70s Moscow. Well, I say studying, not very much studying, actually. Anyway, they were Khoz Ahmed Nukhayev, known as Khoza, who had been, well, he was born in 1954 in Kyrgyzstan. So he was the son of a family of Chechens who had been deported en masse in the very brutal Operation Lentil by Stalin. And he enrolled in the law faculty at Moscow State University. But he was soon expelled for a variety of reasons, including the fact that he didn't really study. He really had just wanted to get to Moscow. And then we had Mavladi Atlangeriev, known as Ruslan, born the same year, this time in Kazakhstan. Remember, the entire Chechen population, after all, had been resettled. So went to study at the Plekhanov Moscow Institute of National Economy instead. He dropped out, actually, and he and Nukhayev got together. They sort of ran in the same circles. They had similar, quite elevated tastes. But, of course, how could they possibly afford those elevated tastes? Particularly when, you know, they're surrounded by what, if you are the sons of Chechens who were brutally deported in the midst of World War II, well, late 70s Moscow, however tawdry it may look, if you go and look at photos and pictures and video now of it, actually was indeed something of a promised land, but you needed money. So what they did is they turned to crime. And in particular, what they started to do was targeting foreign students, international students, usually from allied nations in Africa and the Middle East, many of whom themselves were involved in criminal activity. The point is, they often didn't have much in the way of stipends, but because they, unlike Soviet citizens at the time, could relatively freely travel and could bring in goods that were deficitni, that were exceedingly rare within the Soviet Union. So often they were involved in trading currency or speculating, in other words, buying and selling for profit, in clothing, consumer goods, that kind of thing. So what they would do is often essentially burgle these people's apartments to try and get their stash and their money. And then increasingly, they also turn to, in effect, mugging them or demanding protection money from them. Because the point is, they knew that these victims could not report the robberies to the police because they themselves were involved in criminal activity. Still, the KGB obviously paid particular attention to all the various foreigners in Moscow, not least because it was always looking for opportunities to leverage various indiscretions to recruit agents. And so they very soon became aware of the activities of Khoza and Ruslan. Some people say that they were actually recruited. I'm not convinced that was the case. Rather, I think it's that they kind of clocked them as potential assets in the future. But the point is that they didn't get a chance to perform that role because they made a mistake. And one of their targets apparently was the son of an especially high-ranking African official from an extremely friendly country. I'm unsure which. It might have been Angola. Anyway, the KGB wasn't about to shield them. Quite the opposite. It actually had to step in and demonstrate the efficiency and responsiveness of Soviet law enforcement. So the two guys were arrested, convicted, and sent to prison. And
As so often, life in what was known as the zone, in other words, the prison camp system, really was an academy of crime. I mean, indeed, in the sort of thieves' slang, actually, academia is used to mean a prison camp. A prison camp is an academy. And in particular, what they did is they aligned themselves in many ways with the traditional Blatnoi traditions of the thieves within the code, the old sort of traditionalist approach. So they very much kind of defied the prison administration, they broke the rules, they engaged in brawls, and that got them, you know, quite a bit of punishment from the authorities, but on the other hand, it earned them a degree of respect within the criminal underworld. They were released from prison as seasoned gangsters in 1988. They fit perfectly into the new era in Moscow. Remember, 1988. This was at a time when Gorbachev's quixotic attempts at reforming the system was actually destroying it. And we saw increasing hardships, increasing shortages. We saw growing social unrest, indeed growing nationalist pressures. It's the very end of the war in Afghanistan. The veterans themselves are forming a sort of disgruntled and disruptive subculture. And we also see the move towards the first beginnings of legalized private to commercial activity through the form of the cooperative movement. And the cooperative movement was going to be a bonanza for organized crime in that it was private sector, kind of, and it was also resented by much of the Soviet community and indeed the police because it had to charge higher prices. The idea was higher prices but higher quality. And many of these were very much victims of protection racketeering or they were used to launder the funds from various criminal activities. But anyway, in this increasingly chaotic and freewheeling period in which it's worth noting corruption skyrocketed, which creates all kinds of protection for the criminals, well, this was exactly going to be a bonanza, not just for organized crime generally, but for Khoja and Ruslan. So they started creating their own gang, particularly recruiting from fellow Chechens, because this was a time when turf lines in Moscow were only just being drawn up. Remember, up to this point, there had been organized crime within the Soviet system, but it had had to remain pretty much invisible behind the scenes. In some ways, it acted as the middleman between corrupt party bosses who had power and black marketeers who had access to goods and services that the party bosses wanted. Organized crime often sat in the middle. It provided protection to the black marketeers and it arranged for the corrupt party bosses to get the foreign goods, the whiskey, the clothes, whatever else they wanted from the black marketeers. Now it was beginning to emerge from the shadows, though. It didn't have to fear the state so much. And so, as I said, you have a whole variety of different gangs beginning to divide Moscow up into different spheres of influence. And several of these were Chechens. There were crime bosses like Musa Talarov, who was known as the Old Man, Lecha Beard Islamov. I mean, most Chechens have beards, but presumably, I haven't actually seen a photo of him. Maybe he had a particularly impressive one. Then there was Lecha Altamirov, who's known as Lecha the Bald, and others. I don't want to turn this just into a shopping list of miscellaneous Chechens. Anyway, so Nukaev and Atlangeriev form their own gang. And many of the Chechens whom they recruit bring with them, shall we say, a dowry of existing criminal businesses or indeed contacts. I mean, one of them, for example, was Maxim Lazovsky, who was known as Hramoy, the lame. Now, he was a former traffic police officer from Grozny, but since he'd moved to Moscow, had again built all kinds of relationships within the local police. So, you know, that was what he brought to the gang. So generally, we actually have a group that quite quickly coheres into, by 1989, probably around 40 or so members. And at this point, they don't really have a name.
I mean, they are Horja's and Ruslan's gang, but that's not really much of a name. But they had taken over the Lasagna restaurant. It's again, one of these sort of co-op restaurants. And it became their base on Pitnitskaya Street, so nice and central. Anyway, so because that was their base, that was the place where they were always known to hang out. And indeed, one of their members, Mustafa Shidayev, actually bought an apartment right next to it. Anyway, for that reason, that's why they became known as the Lazanskaya Brigada, or the Lazanskaya Organized Criminal Group. And the Lazanskis, I mean, they were involved in a wide range of criminal activities, fairly typical ones at the time. As I say, a lot of protection, racketeering, cafes, restaurants, clubs, casinos. Also, though, they particularly specialised in Berioska shops. Now, Berioska, that was a Soviet initiative to try and, well, largely to try and milk tourists of hard currency. I mean, I remember you could buy things in Berioska stores you could not buy anywhere else, ranging from, you know, particularly nice souvenirs all the way through to foreign food or very rare, hard-to-find things like caviar and the like. But the point is, these were shops for foreigners which only accepted hard currency. Now, some Soviet citizens also were able to shop in Berioskas because they were given these special vouchers, but they were very much for nomenklatura insiders. Mainly, though, they said this was a desperate way of trying to suck whatever hard currency they could from the wallets of foreign tourists. And, you know, to be honest, you did have to end up shopping at Berioskas. I mean, I remember not so much Berioskas, but also other sort of hard currency shops that opened up. I mean, when I was there doing my PhD, which was from 88 to 1991, yes, you tried to shop in Soviet stores, but by that point, particularly food, it was very difficult to get stuff at all, let alone of any quality. And so I occasionally had to go to the hard currency supermarket in the basement of the Международная, the International Hotel, just simply because after a certain point you think, no, I've had enough. I want to have something nicer. Anyway, so this was a particular target. And why that was important was actually, again, through that they were able to access hard currency, non-rubles, which was very, very important. What else were they involved in? Thefts of luxury cars. We're just beginning to see foreign cars beginning to make it into Moscow streets at this point, and they became quite a target. But actually, ironically enough, they were just too visible. So instead, they focused on things like Chaika limousines and Volga sedans of the best qualities. They were involved in contract killings, but also actually the kidnapping and the extortion of black market entrepreneurs, who were still, many of them, not yet fully legitimized. They were still involved in sort of business you couldn't go to the police if you were targeted with. And increasingly, rather than just simply, you know, burgling someone's flat and seeing what they could find, what they would do is they would kidnap these people, they would drive them out to some hut out in the woods outside Moscow, beat and torture and often, you know, very, very brutally hurt these individuals until they were told where their stashes of cash were. Because at this point, again, you couldn't take it to the banks. So a lot of these people had, usually not in their apartment, somewhere else, but again, literally huge stocks, sacks and sacks of rubles. So that's what they were after. So these were bad guys. And, well, to be honest, quite how bad soon became pretty obvious. The Chechens from the first had a particular reputation as being especially quick to turn to violence and implacable when they did. They would be willing to take risks. They would be willing to be, shall we say, counterproductively violent if need be. This was visible, for example, in 1988. They had a dispute with the Russian Slavic Baumanskaya gang from the Bauman region of Moscow. And what happened was they were known, the Baumanskaya gang was known to, again, have their hangout being the Labyrinth restaurant on Kalininsky Prospect. So at one point, 30 members of the Lazanskaya stormed the restaurant carrying knives, guns not yet really that widely used or available. Anyway, carrying knives, attack the 15 fairly senior figures of Baumanskaya and other Russian Slavic gangs who were present. You know, stab a whole bunch. And the key thing is that both the leaders, both Horja and Ruslan, were present. Again, it was very much a mark of faith that whereas a lot of the Slavic gangs
once you became a leader, you tried not to get involved in the real rough stuff, not because you were a coward, but because you were more likely then to get arrested. But no, here, in keeping with the sort of macho North Caucasus traditions, Nukhayev and Atlangeriev were absolutely present and in the thick of things. And after this point, well, not only did the Baumanskaya gang decide to not actually sort of clash with Lazanskaya, but generally you saw a lot of other gangs thinking, well, maybe we should be thinking twice as well if we had turf conflicts with them. Now, at this point, actually the KGB, which, after all, although we think of it very much as an espionage and internal security force, also was responsible for dealing with serious organised crime, well, they decided that they really started to try and get involved. But it was very difficult, because, again, this is a time of the fragmentation of power. But they did indeed arrest both Nukhayev and, later on, Atlangeriev. But it didn't necessarily work as planned. I mean, Nukhayev, he was sentenced to 8 years on racketeering charges. Those are the ones that they could make stick. And he was sent to a prison camp in Khabarovsk region. And he was there for, what, about a year and a half before, in November 1991, so in other words, very much just before the actual formal collapse of the Soviet Union, a collection of police officers from Grozny, Chechnya, arrive at the camp. And they have papers, genuine papers, according to which a case has been opened against Nukhayev by the Chechen courts, and therefore he had to be transferred to Grozny for interrogation. Well, okay, he's released, he's taken back to Grozny, and once he gets there, lo and behold, a mistrial is declared, and the Chechen Supreme Court annuls the guilty verdict that had been placed on him. So Nukhayev was not just free, he was actually technically legally free. It was interesting, actually, how the Soviet state, and later on the Russian Federation, in some ways would find themselves very much the victims of their own determination to treat Chechnya as if it was still just another loyal member of first the Soviet Union and then the Russian Federation. Because what that did allow is for corrupt and self-serving, but also actually nationalist and secessionist forces in Grozny to essentially use the structures of the central state apparatus against itself. So in this case, technically speaking, the Soviet and then Russian authorities have to accept the judgment of the Supreme Court, just as the Chechen State Bank was used to defraud the central state bank of billions of rubles by just simply issuing false avisos, which are proof of fund documents that say, yes, this amount of money is sitting in this particular account, so you can pay that out. So they would issue these avisos claiming that Chechen so-and-so has got, whatever it is, 10 million rubles in the bank. He can then take that along to the central bank in Moscow, say, I'd like to withdraw my 10 million rubles, please. You see, here is proof that I have it. 10 million rubles will be disbursed. Central bank then turns to Grozny and says, OK, well, in order to balance the books, we have to now accept that 10 million rubles from you. At which point Grozny says, what? Hey, no, nothing to do with us, mate. We don't know what you're talking about. Time and time again, this was done. And there was nothing Moscow could do so long as it was pretending that this was a single unitary apparatus. Anyway, then the Soviet Union collapses. The 1990s. I mean, these were wild guys, and they had wild times now to enjoy themselves in. And particularly, I mean, this is, again, a feature of many of the Chechen gangs, but particularly when we're talking about the Lazanskaya, their degree of violence was really quite noteworthy. I mean, they would time and time again turn up to what were meant to be sit-downs, in other words, meetings to arrange and make an agreement between criminals, instead armed to the teeth, and not even try and negotiate, but just simply turn that into an ambush. As that demonstrated, although they've been happy to kind of play up to the Blatnoi traditions while they were in the prison camp system, the two gangsters and their various henchmen had absolutely no respect for the sort of criminal code and the understandings that were within it about how you resolve disputes, how you had to show respect for the established vori vazakonye, thieves within the code, who are the sort of traditional hierarchs. And indeed, in one particular instance, several of these vori vazakonye, led by man who'd actually then become arguably the most important of all of them, Zakhary Khalashov, who's known as Shakhro Maladoy, Shakhro the Younger. Anyway, they attempted to precisely open some kind of negotiations with the Lazanskaya crime bosses and indeed some other Chechens. And instead, what happened? Well, Nukhayev led an attack on them again with knives. Shakhro himself was stabbed. Now, under other circumstances, that would lead to an immediate sort of mob war. But again, at this particular time, no one really wanted to provoke the Chechens. There is this macho culture that they have, and that sense that, frankly, they will destroy the whole system rather than be defeated. They would not be reasonable. That was an interesting phrase I once had heard, you know, sort of told to me when I was talking to a police officer who had dealt with the Chechens and said this was the thing about the Chechens. They were not reasonable in the way that other gangsters would be, because other gangsters would be thinking about consequences. They didn't care who they took on. I mean, take the Lyubetsy, the so-called the gang that was based in this rather gritty, grimy, proletarian suburb of Moscow, which incidentally had sent a lot of its sons to Afghanistan and therefore had a particularly large proportion of Afghan war veterans in the gang, as well as bodybuilders and the like. Well, you know, even they, frankly, suffered the loss of a whole bunch of their leaders when they got into a conflict with Lazansky. Not through, shall we say, sounds silly to say a fair fight, but, you know, not through the usual ways, but because of ambushes and dry gulching unexpected moments. The trouble is, though, in the short term, fine, that gets you power and, if not respect, the kind of respect that a rabid, salivating dog might get. But what this actually makes is that you become a threat to the collective status quo. So the big Slavic Russian gangs, particularly Arkhovskaya, Solntsevo, Baumanskaya, Lyubretskaya, Balashikinskaya, they all began to think that the Chechens in general and the Lazanskis in particular were going to be a problem. And so they actually began to essentially coordinate. Ironically, this encouraged horizontal ties on both sides. So the Slavic gangs begin to coordinate, and so too the Lazanskis start to find common cause, not just with other Chechen gangs, but also other gangs from the North and South Caucasus. You had an alliance with a gang led by a particularly infamous criminal called Nikolai Suleimanov, and others, like there was a Georgian, Gennady Lobzhanidze, who was known as Gena Shram, Gena the Scarred, Tengiz the Old, whose name was, my mind's gone blank for a moment, Tengiz Marianoshvili, that's it. Now, this mattered because these figures tended to be themselves vori vazakonye, so they had a certain degree of authority. But in particular, they could act as a bridge to other non-Slav gangs and non-Slav traditions, shall we say, at a time when the whole Vorovskoy Mir, the thieves' world, the sort of sense of a common cultural or subcultural community of crime was really breaking down. So there was the risk of what we could think of almost as an ethnic civil war within the Russian underworld in the 1990s, between the Russian Slav gangs and all the various others, the not just Chechens, but Dagestanis and Lezhkins and Georgians and maybe even Armenians and the like. Now, this was something that absolutely began to worry the authorities. But at the same time, a further complicating factor, as if we need further complications, is that the Chechens, and particularly the Lazansky group, seem to have established some kind of ties to the oligarch Boris Berezovsky, who was known as the sort of grey cardinal at the time, had a big media empire as well as an industrial empire, very close to the Yeltsin team and so forth. Certainly his Avtovaz car business seemed mysteriously immune from protection racketeering after he made Magomed Ismailov, who was one of the Lazansky's senior members, a key figure within the Avtovaz security department. So, you know, true or not, whether this was an alliance or what, nonetheless, just simply the rumour that the Chechens were in bed with Berezovsky also, on the one hand, made them all the more formidable, but on the other hand, made this whole issue that much more political. Ultimately, the Chechens' big problem, after all, was just simply that they were vastly outnumbered by the Slavic Russian criminals, but also that their reputation didn't just make them a common target of the criminals, they also began to make them a threat for the FSK, which was the predecessor of the FSB. You know, the KGB, almost biblical, you know, and lo, the KGB begat the AFB, which begat the FSK, which in due course begat the FSB. Anyway, so the Federal Counterintelligence Service, the FSK, is now concerned. First of all, because frankly, the degree of violence and indiscriminate activity of the Chechens is beginning to become an embarrassment. It also is a threat to Slavic gangs that they were actually working with. And there was a particular concern about the link back to the Chechen Republic. I mean, this is the eve of the First Chechen War of 1994 to 1996. And there was a sense that essentially these criminals were going to back the rebels, or at least some within them were going to do so. Now, the real catalyst of the fall of the Lazanskaya group was when it picked a fight with the Orekhovskaya gang in Moscow under the violent but also, unfortunately, depressingly able gang leader Sergei Timofeyev, known as Sylvester. And he very much united the Russian organized crime against them, particularly with the support of Yaponchik, who was a very senior vor v zakonie, Vyacheslav Ivankov. And he was able to bring a lot of sort of traditional authority within the remnants of the Vorovskoy Mir to back Sylvester. And then you also had the FSK, essentially happy to encourage this. They weren't going to be directly involved, but they were certainly going to turn a blind eye when the Russians carried out attacks and come down hard when the Chechens did. As they faced killings, arrests, and in particular cuts in their revenue streams, which matters because everyone's basically in it for the money, Lazanskaya began to fragment. And in this, the Chechen War, the start of the First Chechen War, was absolutely crucial because you had Nuchayev, who was supporting Dudayev's regime, Dudayev being the leader of the sort of breakaway Chechen government. After all, I mean, although it had been well paid to do so, nonetheless, these are the guys who had freed him right the way back in 1991. On the other hand, you had Khoza Suleymanov, one of who's now probably the number three within the gang, who absolutely opposed it and was supportive of anti-Dudayev Chechen forces. Atlan Gireyev tried to stay neutral, presented himself as a potential mediator, both within the gang, but also in the wider conflict, but it didn't really get anywhere. And the war spread from Chechnya to Moscow. Suleymanov, who I said had been fighting on the side of the Chechen anti-Dudayev opposition, was captured by militants. He was ransomed. However, once he got back to Moscow in 1994, he was gunned down by unknown assassins. Nukhayev had joined Dudayev's forces. He'd actually been made a brigadier general of Ichkeria. This is what they called themselves, the Chechen Republic of Ichkeria. And given the country's highest award, the Komansi, honour of the nation. Now, he would return to Moscow in due course, having essentially paid for a degree of absolution, but nonetheless, he was in a way also out of the picture. And what this meant was, in the absence of many of its leaders, the Lazanskaya was getting, bit by bit, ground away. Now, Nukhayev would actually, in due course, as I say, return to Moscow. But before then, while he was holed up in Baku, where he had invested a lot of his money in Azerbaijan, he gave a whole series of very lengthy interviews with the Russian-American, well, American but of Russian origin, extraction, journalist Paul Klebnikov of Forbes magazine. And this provided the basis for what became a book, Conversation with a Barbarian, Interviews with a Chechen Field Commander on Banditry and Islam. And in some ways, it's actually a pretty interesting book, actually. We have Nukhayev discussing his past, including his involvement in criminal activities and in creating the so-called Caucasus Common Market. And you also have Nukhayev arguing, frankly, for the superiority of Islamic Chechen sort of clan and tribal-based social systems. But still, Nukhayev was not at all happy when the book came out in 2003. I mean, let's be honest, Conversation with a Barbarian is not the kind of title which is likely to endear you, especially because at the time he was trying to reinvent himself now as a legitimate political actor. Of all things, he actually got actively involved in the work of Alexander Dugin, the now still infamous Russian nationalist philosopher, anyway, in his Eurasia Party. In 2001, he actually used a party press conference in Moscow to propose that Chechnya be divided into North Chechnya, the plains, the lowland regions within the Russian Federation, and mountainous South Chechnya, which would be a sort of semi-independent, autonomous region, still closely linked to Russia and very much hostile to the extreme Islamic fundamentalism. So, you know, he had this vision, and no doubt he saw himself as a potential kingmaker in South Chechnya. But still, this book came out. It derailed some of his plans, it embarrassed him, and it seems to be that he also thought that Paul Klebnikov had basically pulled a fast one, that he didn't think that it was just going to turn up verbatim in a book. That same, well, sorry, next year, came out in 2003, so this is 2004, Klebnikov was gunned down in central Moscow. And it's assumed that Nukhayev was behind this, and frankly, I think assumed correctly. What was interesting, though, that, again, as Nukhayev was trying to legitimise himself, he was also trying to legitimise himself with the Varovskoy Mir and the rest of the criminal world. And killing an American journalist in Moscow was a big deal. It was interesting at this time that there was still, in effect, an understanding that you don't go after foreigners. Foreigners were the geese that laid the golden eggs. You did not want to scare them away. You just simply wanted to, as the expression went, iron them, to basically get whatever money you could out of them. And the idea of killing someone like Klebnikov was sufficiently sensitive that it actually had to become the subject of a skodka, which is, again, a gathering of underworld leaders. And eventually they decided that Klebnikov was in some ways acting sufficiently Russian, breaking the rules and so forth, that he could be treated like a Russian, which in other words meant that Nukhayev could actually have him killed. That's how I heard it. I mean, I can't actually say this is absolutely proven, but I heard this from multiple sources within both the Russian underworld, but also the Russian police services. So Klebnikov was killed, and fine, that may well have satisfied Nukhayev's desire for revenge, but on the other hand, he wasn't going to enjoy it for long. He would disappear in 2004. Now, one version is that he actually ended up, again, going back and joining the rebel fighters. You know, we're talking about the era of the Second Chechen War, after all, and he was killed in the mountains of Dagestan. According to another, he just simply decided to leave, disappeared forever, and no doubt enjoyed the rest of his ill-gotten gains, sipping daiquiris on a beach somewhere. I don't actually believe that that's true. Equally likely, though, is that he was lying in an unmarked grave or fed into a wood chipper, either by his rivals or by the FSB, who really didn't want him beginning to become a sort of respectable face of Chechen nationalism. Either way, he's out the scene and the gang is in trouble. Now, the irony is, after all, that in the 1990s, the Chechen reputation for violence had actually meant that in some cases they could afford to be less violent because no one was going to mess with them.
And that actually meant that if you look outside Moscow, large swaths of the country, effectively the Chechens could really create a franchise. So in other words, they would allow people to pay for the rights to be able to say, we work with the Chechens, knowing full well that that meant that people were much less likely to push back against them. So in this respect, they had actually managed to quite effectively commercialize their reputation for primal violence. On the other hand, there wasn't really any room for that kind of activity in Moscow. And given the role of several people from within the Lazanskaya gang in the Chechen conflict, it meant that increasingly they were under pressure. They were seen as dangerous. They were seen as kind of a destabilizing force. And that they had therefore had to take risks to a far greater extent, risks that often would basically backlash.